Saltzman's proposal in terms of having the Lentz Urban Renewal Area fund this school. That is patently unfair on its face. Lentz is, by all accounts, a struggling community that is finally beginning to get some traction around the investments that have been made in the town center that is the location between 92nd and about 85th between Foster and Harold. We have just Commissioner Adams and I, since he's joined the council, and I have successfully worked with the PDC to attract a great development onto that site. It's paying dividends. We have a light rail stop that's going in at 92nd and Foster that foretells wonderful development happening in Lentz, all of which is going to require money. We have the opportunity possibly of having a discussion with the community of having Beaver Baseball located out in Lentz, being relocated from downtown out to Lentz. That will require a huge commitment on our part. These are all things that are bright spots in the future that Lentz has never known before. And I will tell you, I've represented Lentz in one capacity or another since 1993. I believe I remain to be the only city council member that's ever gone door-to-door in Lentz. And while I grew up in other parts of the city, I have been shocked at the poverty that exists in Lentz. We now see with the success of that Lentz URA that's beginning to happen that we're ready to turn the corner. This proposal would drain $19 million out of the Lentz URA that would otherwise go to these wonderful projects that the staff of the PDC and the neighborhood out in Lentz is finally making some headway on. So I don't just oppose this proposal by Commissioner Saltzman. I propose it adamantly. It goes against everything that I believe in, not to help out the poorest of the poor and have that help come from the wealthiest in the community. And it also goes against everything I believe in to drain resources away from a very successful neighborhood and PDC staff who are making tremendous strides against some overwhelming odds in a demographic that often people thought would not be possible to help lead out of where they currently exist. So thank you for your tolerance of my remarks.
Can I respond to some of this?
Commissioner Saltzman.
Yeah, I guess I want to respond to a couple points. First of all, my interest and my focus is on one thing, and that is getting an elementary school built for the David Douglas School District. That remains my bottom line interest. There's a lot of talk, you know, we talk a lot about the Willamette Urban Renewal Area as being the great precedent for the satellite district. Well, you know, the reason, as I recall from the discussions, was kind of the unsaid reason why we didn't include the riverbed of the Willamette River as part of that urban renewal area is because the Willamette River bed is a federal Superfund site. And the last thing you want to be doing is creating a potential local funding tax increment district that could be sucked dry by EPA in the name of cleaning up the Willamette River. So that's why we have the district on either side of the river as opposed to including the riverbank. But more to the point, like I said, I agree with everything you said about Lentz. It's turning a corner. There's going to be four light rail stations built there in the next 2 years. There are some great things happening. We learned last week of some great things happening. So I'm simply saying, let's look at the question. Given that there's legal risk associated with the satellite district, legislative uncertainties too, what's the harm of giving PDC the opportunity with the Lentz public to come back to us in 6 weeks and say, we can do this. We can get the $19 million for the school and hold everything else harmless in the plan. Or, you know, or we can't. But what's the point? You know, what harm is there in giving us 6 weeks or giving the process six more weeks, given that we never looked at this option at all in the Urban Renewal Advisory Group, to come back to us and let us, make that decision, satellite or Lentz URA? I just, you know, I don't see the harm, and I think it would be the most prudent course for us to do is to give us more information, not to act on less information.
So to answer that question, since you posed it as a question, the harm is this, that you have a community in Portland that has successfully redeveloped to the extent that they have an assessed value of over $500 million, a budget over $500 million. That allows them to fund more projects than they ever conceived they could possibly fund. And I think one of the basic principles of our country is to try to bring equity to all citizens. And what that means on this local level is to take that huge, and I'll call it surplus, of urban renewal dollars and help fund a school for the poorest area of the city, as opposed to using the limited funds that that poor area of the city has to create some basic infrastructure to begin even attracting some of what has caused the Pearl to develop the way it has. It's, to me, basically unfair on its face to basically say to the poorest section of the city, you shoulder creating your own schools. We can't be burdened by it because we're down here in Northwest Portland wanting to build whatever we want to build that adds to the amenities that we have already, and not share some of that success with other parts of the city, which, by the way, under our new urban renewal formula, really is a burden that all communities face anyway. And I'm sure you understand that. In the urban renewal area that is the River District, those indebtedness are debts that all Portlanders are liable for and all Portlanders fund in their property taxes. So to me, it makes complete sense, and it makes complete economic justice to have the poorest area of the city benefit somewhat by the success of a downtown district.
So if I could make a comment. Underline your suggestion, Commissioner Saltzman, is that this will reduce the legal risk. And I guess I would be more persuaded if those that are threatening legal action hadn't also very clearly identified legal issues that they have with some of our proposed changes on the west side of the river. So while it might reduce it, it doesn't eliminate it. And I'm not persuaded that that we wouldn't be mired up in court anyway. I have to agree that I'd rather take a Robin Hood strategy than take from the poor, quote-unquote, poorer part of town to give to a poorer part of town. We've worked so hard to get the momentum going that there has been established in Lentz, and my fear is that it is going to flip from sort of struggle for new light rail stations, suddenly gentrification. And we've seen that happen in other parts of the city. And one of the few ways that we have as a council to protect against that sort of flip to gentrification is to have cash to control property that we can then work with other property owners to create affordability, to create parks and natural areas. So it's really important to me because I think we're actually underfunded in Lentz, and we've seen gentrification occur when we open up new light rail every place else if we don't have adequate control of property or adequate resources to invest in affordability and everything else that makes a complete neighborhood. I also just want to underscore the reason why I believe the satellite district makes sense. From a policy perspective, is that we put in criteria. I think one of the very legitimate concerns that you can have about the idea of satellite districting or sub-districting is that you could be opening up Pandora's box. And I think that we have established criteria for the establishment of satellite districts prior to or as part of considering these council items that are much stronger and much more stringent than the satellite district created for the Willamette URA. Now, while the explanation is that you wouldn't want to put in the URA highly toxic ground, it is nonetheless a decision made by the City Council to establish a satellite portion to the Willamette URA to avoid that. So it did create and set the precedent of a satellite URA. It did so without any criteria for future satellite districts. This establishes that criteria, and therefore I'm comfortable with moving forward. Any other comment?
Well, I would just respond to a couple points. I see where the votes are going on this, but I do think, well, it's great rhetoric. Taking from the rich and giving to the poor is great rhetoric. We all love it. It may not be buttressed, in fact, by what Oregon revised statutes say with respect to urban renewal agencies, and therein lies sort of the dilemma I find myself in, because my focus is on getting a school built for David Douglas in a reasonable timeline. I'm afraid that our enamorment with taking from the rich and giving to the poor, as I said, it's great rhetoric, we all feel good about it, but I'm not going to feel so good about it 2 years from now if it's still in the Court of Appeals. And in the meantime, we can't do anything. David Douglas can't do anything. The Lentz path may not work out, but then again, we haven't looked, and I think we owe it at least an honest examination, and I think it would provide us a more legally tenable, defensible approach to get the money to David Douglas School District sooner.
Well, there has been suggested a way to facilitate clarification to the legal issues, although this goes through LUBA, is that correct? Let's talk a little bit about sort of the potential path forward. If it is contested, how is it contested, and what's the timeline for contestation?
David Ellett, PDC, Interim General Counsel. If the ordinances adopting the amendments were to be appealed, they would first go to LUBA. The general timeline for an appeal would be 21 days after adoption of the ordinance. After that, I don't have before me the specific details about the timeline, but it would probably be several months during which LUBA would consider the appeal. It would be briefed, and then ultimately LUBA would make a decision. Typically, LUBA decisions involve remands. They identify errors in the process, and it's remanded to the local jurisdiction to address the errors. With respect to the satellite district.
Before we move from that point, though, okay. Doesn't LUBA have to consider this an appeal within a certain timeline, Ben?
I don't know the specific timelines as to, you know, the outcome could be that LUBA makes a determination and remands, or it could affirm the decision, and then it could be subject to further judicial review in the Court of Appeals.
Right, so. But LUBA has a certain timeline that they have to get back to us, is my understanding.
I believe that's the case, but I'm not familiar with it.
I don't know the specific timeline either, but there is. I
think all of our other LUBA appeals, they have to respond to us within a timeline of like 120 days or something.
That may be correct.
Tim, can I ask a question related to that? You said it could be remanded, sent back for some further action by council. Would LUBA's determination that there had been inadequate findings constitute an error that would come back to us, or is that a basis for just denying?
No, I believe that would be a remand issue. They would identify insufficient findings and would remand.
You were going to go on, but do you have any questions on this portion of the LUBA portion?
Yes. Specifically, David, I was at the PDC hearing when you and Linda Meng testified together, and I told others then, and just parenthetically, I want to say while you're present that I really appreciated what appeared to be a really different tone of the what I gathered from that discussion with you and Linda present of the cooperation between you and the city attorney's office tonight, given that I've raised that issue
quietly in the last year.
Appreciate that.
That's amazing.
We're certainly working.
Get the transcript.
Yeah.
I certainly observed what I consider to be the kind of relationship I would expect, and I appreciate that. And what I heard was from you and Linda both was in your analysis of this proposal, you saw nothing that violated state law, state constitution, which isn't to say you said it was risk-free. You didn't say that, but I was listening very careful for you to identify a legal problem, and I never heard that.
I think I would characterize our advice as, in looking at the relevant legal authorities, and there are a number of relevant legal authorities, we've identified interpretations that would support council's action in adopting the satellite district. That said, there is no legal precedent, and as a result of that, there is substantial legal uncertainty as to how LUBA or a court might ultimately view it.
But you would say that on almost any item, given your profession.
There are certainly things
are
that
leading
are clearer
the, are you
than
leading
others.
The witness? Oh.
Yes, I am.
Good answer.
I'm blatantly
good
leading
answer.
The witness.
All right. Any other questions on the LUBA piece of as we understand an appeal, and you're about to move forward with what you think the phase after LUBA would be?
Well, it is possible, and if it's simply an issue of remand, there's always the possibility that the petitioner could appeal, and then that would go to the Court of Appeals, and there isn't any specified timeline during which the Court of Appeals would consider the decision, so that could potentially extend the period of uncertainty indefinitely.
And what are the are there any options to speed up the process? In other issues, we've used declaratory judgments or a version of that. Do you know anything about that?
Linda and I have discussed that briefly. I don't think we've identified anything that would be clearly available in the form of a declaratory judgment or other sort of preemptive decision to avoid an appeal to LUBA.
And we would not be able to move forward, true or false, we would not be able to move forward any aspect of these five council items, or we would be able to move forward anything that isn't remanded to us from LUBA.
The ordinances adopt separate amendments. So if only one of the ordinances were appealed, then the rest of the ordinances would take effect. So it would simply be a question of which, if any, of the ordinances were appealed.
It looks like Ben has an update.
The statute appears to provide a timeline of a final order from LUBA within 77 days after the date of a transmittal of the record. So it is an accelerated timeline, but as David has identified, the uncertainty comes out of the possibility of judicial review following a LUBA determination.
If I could just jump in on that point, because Dan and I listened to about 3 to 4 hours of testimony last week on some of these questions, and my head is still spinning. But, you know, in the PDC budgeting documents that we received, the first money that would be pulled out of the district to cover the school expense would be in 2011, absent a change in priorities. And it's been suggested that you could defer some other project to jumpstart the money. But the kind of projects you'd be deferring would be like the Resource Access Center, and I doubt there's much of an appetite on this body to do that. So the interim way, as I understand it, to get the money would be to have the council, in essence, float the money secured against something. And I think what we learned is that if there is substantial uncertainty about the process, then the council, then the city could not issue the interim debt, and PDC couldn't issue the interim debt. So we were looking at the possibility of up to 2 years or maybe longer, because you don't delay, because in the legal process you don't control how quickly the Court of Appeals addresses it, and that process could take, you know, its own time. Out of that, I think, came, I'm not speaking for Commissioner Saltzman, but some consideration about a plan B. And on the legal side, I've been looking for a plan B for 6 months. I'm not sure I found it. But on the legal side, there might be two plan Bs. One is to take some issues off the table to discourage a challenge. And that, I think, is sort of the spirit of the amendment he's offering. And another one would be to find a way to expedite a decision on the contested legal questions. I don't think there is a way to expedite consideration. And we have a system of checks and balances. I mean, people are free to appeal our determinations. Some higher authority gets to weigh in on it. And it may ultimately be decided by the legislature. That's not an infrequent outcome of an issue the legislative body takes. With respect to shrinking the number of issues that could be subject to appeal, I think that this proposal, as I understand it, would take the satellite district issue off the table and replace it with a cherry stem and do a couple other things. I think it's well-intentioned based on the testimony I heard, but I can't support this amendment, because I don't think, based on what we now know, that it is fair, in fact, to put this financial burden on the Lentz Urban Renewal District, which is already having difficulty generating the kind of TIF that we're talking about. And nor am I convinced that there's a way we could hold them harmless on this point. Again, but I think it's well-intentioned from the point of view of looking at some way of mitigating risk. And there are only two ways on the legal side that we could do it. This is one. But I cannot support this approach.
So follow-up question, and I appreciate the background since Randy and I were not at the meeting, is if we're in the midst at whatever, either at the LUBA level or the Court of Appeals or higher, and we seek and are successful at getting a legislative clarification or change, what impact would that have on the pending legal action? Can we get legislative action that makes the legal stuff go away? Or is it grandfathered in, or do we do this all over again, or?
That's not a question that I have looked at. It seems to me that the legislature certainly would have it within its authority to make the legislation effective in such a way to validate the action, though I think they would probably need to do that quite specifically.
Okay. You have any comment on that, Ben? Do you have any comment on that?
No. I'm prepared to move the amendment so we can go back to general comments, and then I have some more specific comments, but I'll reserve those until we take up.
Prepared to move the amendment or vote against the amendment?
We're about to call the question, I think is what he meant on the amendment. Unless there is additional council discussion or any of our panelists have something that they need to tell us before we vote on Commissioner Saltzman's motion to continue this discussion without action until August 2nd. All right, Carla, please call the roll.
Fish.
No.
Leonard.
No.
Saltzman.
Yes.
Adams.
Again, I know that as Commissioner Fish stated, I know your intentions are honorable, but I just can't support it. No, sorry. Sam, you almost got me there, didn't you?
Sam, you had earlier indicated if we had general comments, this was the right time, and then I'll have a specific comment when we get to the vote on the ordinance. I just want to raise one additional general comment, which is we received a letter dated June 23rd from Bruce Warner responding to some questions that were posed out of the last hearing, and some of them were questions mm-hmm. that Commissioner Saltzman and I raised. And in question number three, Dan and I had asked what's the criteria for evaluating progress within an urban renewal district around job creation? So what's the record of job creation in Lentz? What's the forecast, and what's the way of tracking that going forward? My understanding from the response we got is that that's a work in progress, that they're developing a method in order to evaluate that. But I do think in terms of the credibility of urban renewal districts generally and our ability to make informed decisions, we need a way of tracking job creation and linking our decisions to some kind of economic benefit. And the answer we got says that's a work in progress, and I would hope that we could really jumpstart that process, because I think the relying on metro and bureau planning forecasts is not the same as actually having hard data in terms of past performance and then hard data on an annual basis going forward.
Any other general comments? And then if not, we're going to tick through a vote on each of these, and as people vote on council, they can make specific comments. All right, no other discussion on council. Our first vote is on item 888, second reading.
Fish?
Aye.
Leonard?
Aye.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Adams?
Aye. 889.
Fish?
Aye.
Leonard?
Aye.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Adams?
Aye.
I'm sorry, 890.
Yeah.
Fish?
Aye.
Leonard?
Aye.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Adams?
Aye. 891.
Fish?
Aye.
Leonard?
Aye.
Saltzman?
Aye.
Adams?
Aye. 892.
Fish?
Well, if I could, I'd like to briefly explain my vote.
My wife was joking with me this week that I probably had another week in my honeymoon phase before the recall petition was filed. This may accelerate it. First of all, as the newest person up here and as someone that did not participate as a member of this body on the question on the underlying deliberations that led to this proposal, I have felt that it was important that I do an extensive amount of homework to catch up and to make sure I understood the issues. And I want to say that I found not only last week's hearing incredibly informative, thoughtful, the presentations useful, but in going back through the record of materials we've received, the briefings I got from PDC, the briefings I've had from people on both sides of this issue, the record, the newspaper commentary, everything, I mean, there's a wealth of information, and it's helped me come to my conclusion today. I begin, though, my analysis mindful of the fact that a 5-0 vote of the council launched this endeavor and that there has been a strong support on this body for this particular proposal. And I say that in a sense because I want to recognize that my particular vote and view on this has limited consequence in terms of how this moves forward, given what I understand to be the sense of the council. But I still think that it's important that there be integrity in the way I approach a question of this magnitude and in my thought process. So I will share it with the public. I raised and addressed, in my mind, three fundamental questions as I evaluated this. The first is whether there's a compelling need to take these resources and invest them in the David Douglas School District. I think that's the easiest question to address because I think there's clear evidence that there's a compelling need. One of the benefits of being a candidate is you spend a lot of time out in the community. And I'm reminded when Commissioner Leonard invokes the I-205 barrier, I'm also reminded that when I had the great pleasure of being in a candidate in 2002, and I think, Randy, you might have been in that field. I don't remember, but you might have been an opponent. One of your stock speeches had to do with something called the Forgotten Portland. And it made an impression on me. I've lived in cities that also had forgotten areas. Parts of Queens, for example, in New York, probably qualified as forgotten New York. So I spent some time east of 205, and I am frequently frustrated that leadership people I meet in East Portland don't have relationships with people in downtown, even within the same areas. It tells us that we have a community that's still too balkanized, too separated, east and west. But clearly, as we look at the David Douglas School District, there's an overwhelming body of evidence of the need, starting with the poverty in the community, the overcrowding in the school district, the fact that the tax base just simply can't support what they want to do, and the fact that the political dynamic is such that the voters are unlikely to support the money for this until there's a stronger tax base and a higher per capita income. So the second question for me then is there some precedent for the council's action here that I can in good conscience embrace, which would allow us to direct monies from an urban renewal district to a school? And when we say school, I think it is fair to talk about this more as a community facility than as a school, and for reasons I'm going to point out in a moment. As a citizen of this community, I'm aware that while our charter says very little about schools, the fact is in the 11 or so years that I've lived in this community, the city council has on a regular basis allocated money for the schools. Whether that's general fund money, whether it's tax surcharges, whether it's the Children's Investment Fund, whether it's shared facilities and arrangements with different bureaus to take care of parks and fields and maintain facilities. But let's go further. We have a model which is one of the centerpieces of our planning going forward, which we all celebrate, and that's the Rosa Parks Elementary School model. And frankly, Rosa Parks would not be built today had it not been a unique partnership between the school district, the city of Portland, Portland Parks and Recreation in particular, and I think the icing on the cake, the Boys and Girls Club, that leveraged the money necessary to do this. So, of course, there is a precedent for the council acting to benefit schools, but there is also the additional precedent, which I'll come back to in a moment, through the Willamette Industrial Urban Renewal of having a non-contiguous district. And notwithstanding probably good and sufficient reasons to exclude the polluted bed of the river in the urban renewal area, it was still, I remember that debate as a citizen, and I don't remember much opposition to that. In fact, a lot of people thought it made a lot of sense. So the second question I've had to pose is there some precedent for our action? And I think, indeed, there is. The third question for me does this approach represent good public policy, and is it otherwise legally defensible? On the policy side, in my own view, and I have been probably in the skeptic camp for a while, it's edgy. This is pushing the envelope. This is taking a concept and redefining it a little bit, moving it to the edges, expanding our understanding. Frankly, we do that all the time. Courts are accused of it. Legislative bodies do it all the time. It's part of the creative tension of making public policy. And we have a system of checks and balances which puts us back in alignment if we go too far. But is this any edgier than any other grand vision or plan to address poverty in our community and school equity? No, but it is admittedly an edgy concept. We recognize that. On the legal issue, and I, you know, as people know, I'm a recovering lawyer, I have felt that the legal issues were closer, that there's a closer call. And so I've gone back to read the city attorney's memo and the other documents which are form the basis of our record on this point. After all, I did take an oath. I took this job. And I think I took an oath to follow the law and not join the Democratic Party. I believe that was, in essence, what I agreed to. I think the city attorney's memo contains some qualified advice on legal questions, but I think generally, in the absence of legal precedent, what the city attorney was doing on our behalf was making some predictions, but in the absence of clear precedent for some of the points. And it is not unusual, I think, under those circumstances, that our attorney would advise a dual-track route of considering, in addition to whatever other remedies are, seeking legislative clarification. Clearly, that's always the best, because courts get it wrong, other bodies get it wrong, legislatures can clarify their intent. For me, the issue, though, as I have studied it in greater detail, is not one of black and white. If it were black or white, I would have a harder time today. It's gray. I believe we're in a gray area where reasonable people on both sides of the issue can make arguments about blight and satellite districts and findings and funding schools. But I think reasonable people have made compelling arguments on both sides of that issue. So I do not believe that it is a black and white issue. I believe it is gray. And I think that there are lots of reasonable people on both sides of this discussion. I want to come back to the question of checks and balances, because ultimately, I don't think it is our role to, with some kind of precision, divine how a court or some other party is going to tackle the legal issues. That's not our charge. We have a system of checks and balances. Courts routinely overturn actions of legislatures. That's part of our system of government. It allows sometimes legislative bodies to take risks, knowing that if they stray too far, there may be a court or a tribunal to put it back in equilibrium. And the system of checks and balances in this case, I think, gives us an additional measure of protection if we choose to move forward. Now, the three other factors that I considered in my decision today. One was a comment and relates to something Commissioner Adams alluded to earlier, which is we have an underlying resolution of the council which puts some very strict limitations on the use of satellite districts in the future. And that resolution limits the opportunity for creating future satellite districts and puts what I think are reasonable restraints on what we can do. And I want to be very clear, I do not view the resolution that's before us today to be a case of opening the floodgates to satellite districts for every school district in the city going forward. I'm not aware of any commitments that have been made in that regard, and I reserve the right to look at each one on a case-by-case basis. But I do think the council, contrary to some who've been quoted in the press saying that the floodgates have been opened here, I think the council has put some teeth into its limitations on future satellite districts. A second point I want to make is that I have for some time been trying to find a plan B that I could test against this proposal that meets the goal of providing educational equity funding support, attacking poverty in East Portland, but does not present perhaps the same level of legal risk. And as of today, I've not found it, nor have any of the critics or proponents come forth with a plan B that I think is compelling. And so I want to close with a comment about poverty and equity. When I was sworn in, is probably my second or third swearing-in ceremony. I forget. We want to extend this as long as possible. I said that we are not going to be a truly great city until everybody in our community enjoys the benefits of a livable community. And the work of the Coalition of a Livable Future and other groups have shown us that there are many underserved areas of our community that simply do not get the right level of services and do not enjoy the same kind of livability that we do closer to the inner core. And that's got to change. And I also said in my swearing in that I wanted to help lead an effort on this council to tackle poverty, issues of poverty, get to root causes, declare war again on poverty, because no one sitting up here believes it's acceptable that as many people in our communities are today live in poverty and substandard housing, inadequate wages, don't have health care, and on and on and on. And I think we have a chance to seize this moment and do something great to tackle poverty. And when I look at the values of the people sitting up here, I'm convinced we can work together to make this happen. So I'm an imperfect person. I have reservations. I've weighed the evidence and the factors that are important to me. I've thought long and hard about this. And on the basis of what is my best judgment today, notwithstanding my reservations, I'm going to vote aye.
Leonard.
Well, I have to first start by saying that I am nearly speechless by your excellent remarks, but I want to remind you that I said nearly. You really summed up for me in a very articulate and thoughtful way why this project should go forward, so I really commend your reasoning, Commissioner Fish, and appreciate it a lot. And you did touch on a lot of the issues that I wanted to describe before I voted. So I will just talk about those things, a couple things that you didn't mention. First thing I want to make clear is that there are those that sometimes watch this council that sees disagreements and misinterprets that as being us either fighting or quarreling or not getting along. I couldn't disagree more. I find our city council to be a very healthy representation of the community, and we have honest discussions and debates, and it's healthy for people to know that we do that here and not in some back room. We have these discussions about the things that we believe in front of the entire community. Commissioner Saltzman put forward an amendment that I know for a fact is based on his sincere desire to provide the best education for people in this community that are the most needy of education. And I don't need to defend Commissioner Saltzman. I'll just point out his constant and tireless work in the Children's Levy and other programs that he's put forward on behalf of kids in this community that are left out. And I want to acknowledge that and say that nobody should interpret him and I disagreeing with me not having the utmost respect for him and his motives in whatever he does. And I want everybody in the community to know that as well. Having said that, this is in many ways a watershed moment in our city. And it isn't because of the historicness of creating a satellite district. It's because of this acknowledgement by the council of the communities that do exist post-annexation east of various places from 42nd out to 122nd and the areas of the city that are acquired in the last 20 years. It is really the first time that this council has acknowledged that we owe the same kind of opportunities, the same kind of advantages that every other kid in the historic sections of Portland have received as well. And I'm deeply appreciative of the action of the council today. I look forward to this being a unanimous vote. I'm hopeful that the communities in the areas affected by this vote, beyond just David Douglas, recognize this watershed moment, that it's really a long time coming, but definitely a testament to the excellent work done by our school districts in the areas east of I-205. And I would just close with this. I would ask that if there are those that are focused enough on their opposition to this, that they intend to take some kind of action beyond this, I would ask you to do one thing, just one thing. Please call Barbara Rommel. Go out and meet with her, as I have done. And if you'd like, I'd be happy to attend as well. If you don't want me to be there, I won't. But please just sit down and listen to what they do and listen to what they deal with and listen to the kinds of opportunities they're trying to provide kids in this community. I was troubled particularly by one thing that I heard at the hearing that I wasn't at last week, but I listened to subsequently, that building a school in East Portland is somehow not economic development that should be associated with the Pearl. I couldn't disagree more. It is fundamental to this community and to this nation that we begin understanding that educating our youth and providing the resources to compete on a worldwide scale is more economic development than it is anything else. It allows our families, it allows our kids to compete and put the U.S. back in a place that it has long since lost, and that is being in the forefront in the world on information, on education, and competitiveness in an ever more competitive world in terms of attracting industry and jobs to this country. And we're losing them to other countries because we don't understand that education is economic development. So if you would do me that one favor, I would be extremely grateful of meeting with Barbara before you took any kind of action. And then after that, if you're still compelled to do what you have to do, I respect that. So thank you for this excellent discussion. Thank you to my colleagues, and I vote aye.
Saltzman.
Well, I think this has been a great discussion, and you know, notwithstanding my concerns about legal risk, you know, I do support us helping the David Douglas School District, and if the River District satellite is the chosen way to go to make that happen, you know, I think I'm still capable of being edgy, even though I'm the dean of the, I think I'm dean of the delegation up here now, but I'm still capable of being edgy and taking risks. So I'll be happy to go down arm in arm in this trail as we see how it all plays out. Aye.
Adams.
Well, I do think, you know, I just got back yesterday from helping to lead a delegation of citizens and neighborhood and business leaders. We visited looking at best practices and meeting with businesses in Germany, the Netherlands, Sweden, and Finland. And had an opportunity to talk to, there are about 50 people on the trip, and this issue came up from some folks. And I was surprised by how many people had not been to neighborhoods in East Portland. And so, ironically, I think we need to have some missions that take folks from various parts of the city to other parts of the city. North Portland, where I come from, definitely feels slighted by the city in some important ways as well. And as a candidate for the past half year, it was interesting. Most every area of the city feels like they're being ignored to a certain degree by the city council and city government. Except for the Pearl. And then when you go to the Pearl, they complain to you about challenges that they have as well. I do think getting a factual basis to our overall work is absolutely important. Over the next 6 months, I'll be working on that as a mayor-elect and would hope to have the council you know, would be supported by our discussion, supported by sort of more baseline information in the future, not just in economic development, not just in areas of poverty, but in the entire responsibility for city government. I'm going to support this. I believe it's the right thing to do substantively and in terms of process. I understand that others disagree, and there is a process in place to sort of adjudicate that disagreement, both through the courts and through the legislature. And I will work with others to clarify this point in the legislature, and we'll move forward. Aye. That gets us to item 893, non-emergency ordinance. Could you please read the title?
Vacate a portion of Northeast 44th Avenue south of Northeast Halsey Street, subject to certain conditions and reservations.
Are there any questions from the City Council regarding this proposal to vacate a portion of Northeast 44th Avenue? Hearing none, this moves, unless objection, to a second reading next week. Item number 894.
I have two people who signed up.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. Do you want to waive your...
We'll waive our testimony.
Bless you.
That was Michael Robinson and Susan Hathaway. Mark.
I apologize. Anyone else in the room would like to testify on 893?
Got one person.
Okay. Please come forward. You can go ahead and stay up here. Hi. Welcome to the City Council, and please state your name, and you have 2 minutes.
Hi. I won't take that long. My name is Susan Hathaway Markser. I live in Irvington at 2136 Northeast 22nd. I'm on the Sullivan's Gulch Trail Committee, and I'm not able to be here next week, so that's why I want to give my testimony now. The Sullivan's Gulch Trail Committee is an informal group of people who are on the watch to make sure that this project will be able to happen as we intend. We have no problem with the street vacation, with the condition that the reservation for the public access easement over the entire vacated area is a part of it. Because the trail is not on comp plan, and because the engineering study hasn't been done, we are very mindful, very watchful of anything that will affect connectivity between what we presume will be the trail and the public right-of-way. So those are our feelings about it. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, and I'm a big fan of the proposal on the Sullivan Gulch Trail. My understanding is that this provides the necessary sort of preservations and conditions to allow us to move forward with that.
It does. Mm-hmm. The easement is reserved.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Unless there's anyone else to testify or additional council discussion, item 893 moves to a second reading next week, which gets us to item 894.
Vacate North Heinemann Street, east of North Lombard Street, subject to certain conditions and reservations.
Any questions from the City Council on this proposal? Is there anyone here that has signed up that would like to testify on item number 894? Hearing none and none signed up. This moves to a second reading for next week. That's item 894.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. Thanks for your work. I think we're going to consider together, of course, vote separately on items 875, 895, 896, 897. Is that correct? All right. Would you please read the titles?
875. Extend a franchise granted to Time Warner Telecom of Oregon, LLC, to build and operate telecommunication facilities within city streets. 895, extend term of right-of-way agreement granted to Sprint Spectrum, LP, to build and operate telecommunication facilities within city streets. 896, extend term of right-of-way agreement granted to AT&T Wireless Services of Oregon, Inc., to build and operate telecommunication facilities within city streets. 897, extend term of right-of-way agreement granted to VoiceStream PCS I, LLC, to build and operate telecommunication facilities within city streets.
Ben.
Good afternoon. Ben Walters with the Portland City Attorney's Office. If I could just offer a point of clarification, 875, which was pulled from the consent agenda, because I understand that there were some concerns about how it related to 895, 896, and 897, which are franchises, they prefer to call them permits for wireless facilities in the right-of-way. 875 is actually for a telecommunications provider that has offers telecommunication services over hard lines that are in the right-of-way. Time Warner, the reason for the extension on the Time Warner franchise is that we're in litigation with them. We have an appeal that's pending in the Ninth Circuit, and the extension is to preserve the status quo while we're awaiting the scheduling of oral argument on that appeal and a ruling from the Ninth Circuit on the appeal. So it is not a wireless facility. A wireless provider, as are Sprint, AT&T, and VoiceStream. So if the council does want to discuss that, we'd be happy to discuss it, but it is not of the same nature and quality as of the other three.
Sam, based on that representation, my comments can be limited to the emergency ordinances, and I have no objection to the matter which we yanked off the consent agenda.
And so there's no provision in that agreement that would provide for wireless service?
No, there is not. The services they provide are primarily as a long-distance hauler of data.
Okay.
They do have some local provision of services, but they do not provide wireless that we're aware of. They do not have any wireless facilities in the right-of-way.
Okay.
My comment on that, just for the record, as a continuous effort at education of the public and the City Council, is on 875, especially to a much lesser degree on the wireless, is City Council General Fund receives resources from the franchise agreement, or whatever you call it, of 875 that goes to the General Fund, of which only a portion of that goes to the Portland Office of Transportation to pay a portion of the electric bill for the lights, street lights. So the city general fund receives more resources for giving access to providers like Warner than they give to the Portland Office of Transportation. Thank you for listening. I feel better. Go ahead. On 895.
Would the council prefer to take a vote on 875 first and get that one out of the way?
Just go ahead.
875 is a non-emergency.
So unless there is objection from the City Council, 875 moves to a second reading next week.
So with may I, can we just treat as if 8, 9, 5, 6, and 7 are before us and ask questions of of the witnesses?
Go ahead.
I want to just clarify why it is that I asked that we have an opportunity initially to yank the one matter off the consent agenda and now to talk about these as a package. About 6 months ago, I was in Arbor Lodge at a neighborhood association meeting. I think you and I were both there. And during the course of that neighborhood meeting, where I was simply there to be an observer as a candidate, a group of concerned neighbors came forward and talked about the placement of a cell phone tower in front of a residential, in front of a home around the corner from the school. Now, I'm going to just pass this down so my colleagues can see it. This is the tower that was appeared almost overnight in front of a modest bungalow in North Portland. And in the course of the evening, as I listened to the petition made by the neighbors, what I learned was that a notice had gone to people on that street, I believe from PGE, saying there'd be some interruption of their electrical service or their service, maybe their phone service, to do some upgrading of equipment. But the notice did not say that there was going to be a cell tower put on the street. The folks, according to the people who came out to the neighborhood association, the people that were involved in installing the cell phone tower were combative and rude to the folks who lived in the street. The couple that actually owned the home in front of which was placed the cell phone tower were present, and they complained of enormous amounts of anxiety and stress, inability to sleep. There was a transponder of some kind that accompanied the cell phone tower that was buried in the sidewalk, in the right-of-way in front of their house, that emitted a low-frequency signal that they found very disturbing, and neighbors across the street and down the street claimed was very disturbing to them. In the course of the evening, Dave, I learned that Congress, in its great wisdom, has declared that we have no authority to even consider the health aspects and implications of putting cell phone towers of this size with the equipment in a residential area. And there was a lot of concern in the room. And frankly, one of the first things that I thought about was I live in the Grant Park neighborhood, and there are no cell phone towers in my neighborhood like this. They're certainly not in front of homes and residences. And it wasn't clear to me how it was that this particular cell phone tower ended up in North Portland in front of this particular house. And when people said that they felt that there was there were health consequences of this tower being in front of their house, it wasn't very reassuring to them to be told that Congress had essentially told them not to worry about it, that it's not something we can consider. And so in doing a little more homework on this, I learned that there's a healthy debate in the community about whether these towers should really be placed on existing poles on arterials where they can be, where there's less of an impact on neighborhoods. And some of the trade-offs, costs, reasons that they're put in one place and not the other. And based on that, I've asked Commissioner Saltzman if we could be involved, my office could be involved in his ongoing review of this matter, because I have a concern that these are being placed in neighborhoods where the decision may be largely driven by cost or perception that there'll be less pushback than by the need. And I think with our current technology, I'm a little surprised to learn that we have to have a cell phone tower in a residential area where you could easily put one two blocks away in an arterial. And I'm surprised to hear people say that there's a coverage issue if you don't put it in smack dab in the middle of a residential area. So the question that I had as this matter came forward was, in extending the right-of-way agreement, have we in any way lost any leverage we would have as the council to address the concerns that I've just enumerated with Sprint and AT&T and VoiceStream? And my question to you is, both to council and to the Office of Cable Communications and Franchise, if we adopt these, if we extend the terms of the right-of-way, are we in any way diminishing our leverage in negotiating some good neighbor agreement or restrictions on the placement of cell phone towers generally?
Commissioner Fish, Council, Ben Walters again. The process that the council followed originally in adopting and encouraging providers to locate in the right-of-way was to authorize the cable office to develop a model and then come back to council with a that model and then proceed with granting approval. And so this is not outside of what the council has done before. What is occurring now is that there is essentially we're maintaining the status quo as to these three entities and others. The cable office is out, as you noted, holding public hearings on issues identified in the various neighborhoods about the locating of facilities in the right-of-way. Has conducted an extensive survey with on the internet, soliciting input from the neighborhoods about the approach and how to proceed, and is in the process now of developing a model which will be brought back to council. And once that model is reviewed, then the cable office will proceed with bringing the individual agreements forward, not unlike what happened before. So we're not losing leverage. We're just maintaining the status quo as to these entities which have facilities in the right-of-way. And there will be a process by which these come forward to council. There will be a public hearing process. The council will get an opportunity to weigh in on what the cable office has developed in response to neighborhood input. And then the individual agreements will then be put in place with these entities that, for now at least, are going to continue to operate under the...
How long are these agreements?
These are being extended for a period of an additional year.
How did this particular cell phone tower get the authority to be installed in a residential neighborhood in the right-of-way?
They do it all the time.
Sorry, answer the question. This particular tower is in the nature of a coverage tower. It's to address demands in the neighborhood.
I understand that part. What I'm asking is, who in the city authorizes the placement of the tower exactly where it is?
Well, the way that these things proceed is the utility comes in and actually applies for the replacement of a pole. The facilities are actually on a PGE pole, and so it's the utility that makes the application. The pole is owned by the utility. The facilities are there by permit from the utility.
But if I could just try to know, there is no sign-off from a city employee.
Yes, there is. David Solis, Program Manager, Office of Cable and Franchise Management. Following up on what Ben said, your Office of Transportation Street Systems Management issues the pole replacement permits, or if the pole is not replaced, they issue a permit for the placement of antennas on existing poles.
Who does?
But PDOT.
Street Systems Management in Transportation.
PDOT is operating under the assumption, PDOT does not feel that it has authority to say no or to place it down the street.
That's correct. And in fact,
I just want to be clear that isn't really a sign off.
I see. Right. I agree.
Well, explain to me why we don't have authority to say where these are located.
Because, first off, the existing agreements don't reserve that authority, and secondly, that very issue is under litigation up and down the West Coast.
Which gets to Commissioner Fish's point. If the existing agreements don't allow for that, and we're today voting on the agreements, why shouldn't we not vote on these agreements until we have written into them language that allows us to prevent things like this?
Commissioner Leonard, a couple of points there. The first is that some of these agreements are close to expiration, and if there's an expiration, then the question comes up of what is their authority to continue to operate in the right-of-way. There would be a disruption of service for these providers if they
isn't
were
required. Isn't that the leverage that Commissioner Fish is talking about?
Well, but we don't have a replacement policy to offer up at this point in time.
We do if they would come in and say, gee, we can't let this expire. What do we need to do to make it right? And you say, I have a suggestion. You could agree to us with language that allows us to regulate where these things go. And then we can put it in and you'll have an agreement.
Well, in essence, that's the policy that Cable and Franchise Management is working on right now.
If that's the case, well, if that's the case,
will it be done, Dan?
Could we shorten the renewal term so that we have a? I mean, if there's a sense of the council. By the way, just so you know, the notice that PGE issued to this customer before this was placed in front of the House, this is the written notice that the person got.